Open your Bibles to John chapter 8. We're going to continue our series from the book of John this week. And it was great to have Patrick singing with us today. Great job. And Mark Edwards playing drums for us today. Thank you so much. I was thinking, the more Sue talked about Thanksgiving meals a while ago, the shorter and shorter my sermon time was getting. At least the shorter and shorter your attention span was getting. My sermon could go on and on, I guess, but that would be a mistake. It's so hard to preach John and just to have a short time to do it because you can't do everything that's in there. And last week I preached from John 5, and I'm going to totally skip 6 and 7, and we're going to read in 8. But I mean, there's just so much good stuff in here. I mean, chapter 6, Jesus walks on the water. He feeds 5,000. That story is like, I think, the only story that's actually in all four Gospels. So it's probably really important, but I'm skipping it anyway. There's so much good stuff. But, you know, I talked about at the beginning how John focuses primarily, even though the bulk of Jesus' ministry was done up north in Galilee, that John focuses particularly on trips that Jesus made into Jerusalem for the Feast of the Jews. And in chapter 7, Jesus goes to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Tents or Booths, which was a celebration of the 40 years of the Israelites wandering in the desert or the wilderness, and they lived in tents. It's also called the Feast of Ingathering because the work in the fields was finished and the time had come to rest and to celebrate the abundance of the harvest. And it was a time of great rejoicing, and it lasted for 7 days. But then tagged on to the end of that, the Feast of Tabernacles was 7 days, and then there was an 8th day called the Last Great Day, which was a further day of celebration. And during the Last Great Day, there was this a ceremony where a priest would take a golden pitcher and he would lead these singers and people playing flutes, and there would be dancing, and he would lead a procession from the temple, off the Temple Mount, down all the way to the Pool of Siloam, and he would take this golden pitcher and dip it into the Pool of Siloam, and then that procession would go all the way back up to the temple, and he would pour the water out of the golden pitcher into a big silver bowl, and it was to symbolize God pouring out his blessings on Israel, which would be ultimately fulfilled in God pouring out the blessings in sending the Messiah. But also, it was the Feast of Tabernacles was very connected with water, and specifically rain, because every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, they would pray for rain for the coming year. In fact, in Zechariah 14, I'm not going to take time to read that, but if you're interested, go there. And God actually says, if you don't come up to Jerusalem and celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, it won't rain. And so water, which we take for granted so easily, was not taken for granted by them. Water meant life. So a part of this celebration and thanking God for what had happened was also praying for what would happen and for God to continue to pour out his blessings. But they were thanking God for all the God's providence during their wandering in the desert. And there were two great symbols. One was water, and the other was light. Because one of the things besides water from, when you think about how God took care of the Israelites while they were wandering in the desert, God sent water from a rock. He sent manna for them to eat. He sent quail. Their shoes didn't wear out. And also God went with them. It talks about in Exodus chapter 13, it says the presence of God was with them as a pillar of fire to give them light. And so water and light were kind of the two great symbols of the Feast of Tabernacles that Jesus was in Jerusalem celebrating. And we're not going to take time to look at it very closely, but in on the last great day, when the priest would have led that procession down to the Pool of Siloam and poured the water out, and they were thinking about how they would die if they didn't have water, Jesus stands up on the last and greatest day. It's chapter 7, 30-something. You know, it's right there. Just look it up. And Jesus stands up on the day that ceremony was taking place, and he says, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me." When they're thinking about God pouring out his blessings and how they needed God to pour out their blessings, pour out his blessings, or they would die. "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him." Jesus is claiming to be the fulfillment of that prophecy, the fulfillment of this thing that they're celebrating, what they were looking forward to. But I don't have time to preach about that. So water was really important, but also light. In their wanderings in the desert, God was with them in a pillar of fire to give them light. But also, there's so much in the Old Testament about light being a symbol of God's presence and God's salvation. Isaiah 42, verse 6, it says, "I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles, to open the eyes of the blind and to free captives from prison, to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness." God was a light for them, and he says, "But I choose you, and I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to hold your hand, and what I'm going to do is make you, I'm your light, but I'm going to make you a light to the whole world." And the impact of you being the light is that there will be healing and reconciliation and freedom. Release from prison. It says to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. And there's all kinds of dungeons of darkness that we sit in. But God says, "I'm going to be your light, and then I will make you a light." And the impact of that is healing and liberty. Freedom for the world. A little bit later in John 8, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world." Not only does he claim to be the fulfillment of that focus on water in the Feast of Tabernacles, but in 8 he's still at the same feast. But again, he continues to teach the people, and he continues to reveal himself. We're going to read about an interaction that he had with a particular woman and some Pharisees who brought her to him. 25 years ago, Sue and I went with a group of people from here in Atlanta to plant a church in Detroit, Michigan. And it's hard to believe that was 25 years ago. At that time, I was like 25 years younger than I am now. And so are all of you. So are all the other people who went. You know, the Pierces were on that church planting. Emmy was one. I think Nathan was 11 at the time, I think. So they were little bitty kids. Paul Peeler was there. He was my roommate before I got married. Matt Kobe was from Michigan, but he joined us shortly after we moved there. Michelle Fowler Peeler was my leasing agent at the first apartment I lived in. And then Virginia became a part of the church a little bit later on. So there's just people all over the place here who were Sonia Thomas, Sonia Stroud at the time, quite a few people here that were a part of that. But when we moved up there, I was a ministry intern here in Atlanta, and went up there, and Sue and I were ministry interns for a while in the church planning, but less than a year later, we got out of the ministry, and I went back to my career in graphic design. Sue was a school teacher, and she eventually found a teaching job up there, and we did that we stayed in Detroit 10 and a half years, and we weren't in the ministry most of that time. But we led various things, but the deal is, I didn't preach that often. Even when I was a ministry intern, we led groups and we led Bible studies and we led Bible discussion groups and that kind of thing. But as far as preaching goes, I didn't preach very often. Maybe once a year. And I enjoyed preaching. I wasn't very good at it. But, you can't really get good at it until somebody lets you be bad at it for a while. That's just kind of the way it is, and so I'm still working on being bad at it and to get good at it. So, but whenever I got the chance, I wanted to do really well, and so they would ask me again. But I remember one time in particular, they asked me to preach on Sunday, and they wanted me to do a lesson on the cross. Pretty heavy sermon, but I was up for it. I was glad to do it. I was very happy and honored to do it. And I was into it. And I was preaching. And I thought it was going pretty well. And I was kind of, the point I was making at the time was that it was Satan's desire for Jesus to just give up, to quit. And I think it was one of the reasons why his crucifixion was particularly brutal. And here's what I mean. It was really, from things that I read, it was not common for somebody to be sentenced to be flogged and crucified. It was almost like getting two death sentences. And so I was preaching it, and I was going to town, and the audience is kind of quiet, and it's intense, and I'm preaching, I want to make this point, and I said, it was almost unheard of for somebody to be sentenced to be flogged and circumcised. And of course they said, well, those Romans were mean. I did not know that. And it was at this really intense point, everybody's so quiet. And I say, circumcised. And everybody just goes. And I thought, they're never going to ask me again. There was this uncomfortable silence, and then finally I just went. And then that was the kind of the comic relief for everybody to erupt into just crazy laughter. None of us like to be embarrassed. But it's one thing to be embarrassed because you made an honest mistake. It's another thing to be embarrassed because you really messed up. Because you put your foot in your mouth, or you weren't thinking, or maybe you were thinking. But you get caught doing something. I remember this time in college, I was riding in a friend's car. It was a classic Mustang. And for those of you who haven't been in old cars, some of you were born decades after this car was made. Back in those days, seat belts didn't retract. You had to put the seat belt on it, and then you kind of pulled it over to cinch it up to the right size. And I get in my friend's 67 Mustang, and I sit, and I pull the seat belt up, and it clicks out here. And I start running my mouth off, going, who in the world sat in this seat last time? And I got two or three kind of derogatory statements out of my mouth before I caught my friend's face out of the corner of my eye. And my friend was going. Because this was a group of us going out to do something after church. But the person who had ridden in that seat coming to church was a girl that was now in the back seat. And when I figured that out, I thought, I am going straight to hell. I am a terrible person. I mean, it's hard for me to tell you this story now, 35 years later, or however long it was, you know, I think it's 30 or 35 years ago. It's vivid in my mind because I had just put it out there, and when you say it, you can't unsay it. That's a problem with stuff we say and that stuff we do, is you can't unsay it and you can't undo it. You just got to sit there and be exposed. And it's one thing to say circumcised instead of crucified, and it was a slip of the tongue, and it's embarrassing, and it's kind of funny, and I did something dumb. It's another thing to feel like I'm a bad person. It's the difference between embarrassment and shame. Shame says, I am not worth anything. And that's how we feel sometimes when we get exposed, when we get caught. There are other stories that I could tell you that I'm not going to tell you because they're worse than that. And this one's hard to say, but there's some of them that I'm just not going to say, because they're too shameful and they're too painful. Times when, you know, especially when you get caught, you know, you didn't confess it. There's some kind of nobility about you just have to get it out, and you confess it and you talk about it. And then those times you just flat get caught. You wanted to hide it because you're ashamed. But you get caught, and then you feel like we're all feeling right now, the way you cringed when I told you the dumb things that I said in that car, and worse. Chapter 8, verse 2 says, at dawn, Jesus appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him. And he sat down to teach them. That was their normal position of a teacher at the time, was sitting. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now what do you say? They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. Go now and leave your life of sin. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. It says the teachers of the law and the Pharisees bring this woman to Jesus who was caught in the act of adultery. It seems like the whole genre of reality TV is built around our obsession with cringeworthy moments. Like for some reason, they think the situations that are so unbearably uncomfortable that you just about squirm out of your seat. And say, let's just make about 150 different TV shows that do that. There's some kind of human obsession with these completely uncomfortable moments, unless, of course, you're the one being exposed. But this woman is brought in by the Pharisees, and you know, when the word Pharisee has come to be synonymous with hypocrite, with religious leaders who pile up heavy loads on other people, but they're not willing to lift a finger, and that's because Jesus, challenged them in that way, especially in Matthew 23. That's kind of like the core of all those confrontations of Jesus with the Pharisees, but that's not the reputation that they had at the time. See, what was going on is in the 4th century B.C., the Jews had come out of exile in Babylon, and they had returned to Jerusalem, and they rebuilt the temple, and they rebuilt the city. And even though they returned to Jerusalem, the glory of the former years never did return. And they had lived for hundreds of years with a sense that something was missing. And that was a part of their longing for the sending of the Messiah. Is that when the Messiah comes, he's going to set everything right, and we're going to have the glory and the blessings that we had in the past. Israel is going to return to prominence. And that was really tied up in this longing and the watching for the Messiah. And it was a lot of what was going on at the Feast of Tabernacles. But as the years went on, and years turned into decades, and decades turned into centuries, people just started wandering away from God. They became very cavalier about God's covenant with them. And the way that God was their light, and God wanted to make them a light to all people. And they got very cavalier and nonchalant about obeying the law. Putting God's laws into practice. And there was this group called the Pharisees, and that word Pharisee means separated ones. They said, we're gonna separate ourselves out and live apart from all the lukewarmness and the complacency and the disregard for God's covenant that's going on and that's been going on for years. And what we're going to do is bring about spiritual and moral and theological reform. And we're going to take Israel back to the glory of the past. And their focus was zealous, passionate pursuit for obedience to the laws of God. And all that is really good stuff. And that's what they were about. But over time, what happened is this zealous and passionate pursuit for obedience to the laws of God became a legalistic and condemning approach. A very self-righteous approach to a relationship with God. It kind of devolved into something other than what it started out as, which is not really that uncommon in among us humans. But they come in and they drag this woman in who they say was caught in the act of adultery. Nothing more needs to be said about the humiliation and the shame that she was feeling, but right away it starts raising questions. She's caught in the act of adultery. Where is the guy? At this point, are the Pharisees really interested in purifying Israel and a zealous and passionate obedience to God's command? Just their brutal and unfeeling hypocrisy overshadows the immorality of the woman, actually. But it says, verse 6, they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. Does that verse seem curious to you? It says, they set up this. This was a trap. This was a kangaroo court. This was something they fabricated. Not that she actually wasn't caught, but they caught her and then said, here is a chance to trap Jesus, and they want a basis for accusing him. Who were they going to accuse him to? Well, you realize later on that when Jesus is actually crucified, the one that condemned him to death was Pilate, right? Not Caiaphas the high priest. It was Pilate. Because under Roman domination, the Romans allowed the people that they conquered and dominated to run their own government, and they could pretty much do their whole legal system. They could do everything except the death penalty. And the Jews knew if they wanted Jesus put to death, they had to go to the Roman government to get it done. So it's like they thought, okay, this woman's caught in adultery. The law says that she should be stoned. Let's take her to Jesus. Let's cause a scene. Let's interrupt his teaching session. And we're going to see what he does, because she ought to be put to death. Let's ask Jesus what he's going to do, because if he says she ought to be stoned, we can go to the Romans and say there's a preacher out here trying to institute the death penalty and get him in trouble with Rome. If he says, come on, let her slide, they can go to the Jewish establishment and say he totally disregards the law of Moses. We've got him in a catch-22. No matter what he says, we've got him. Or so they thought. So Jesus reacts to this totally callous, embarrassing situation by stooping down and writing on the ground. I'm picturing playing sandlot football with the other kids, and you get in the huddle, and the quarterback sits down, and in the dirt he draws out the plan that you're going to do, you know. You're like, this is perfect. We've got him no matter what he says. And he stoops around and just starts doodling in the dirt. There's been, this invites speculation, right? Anybody who's read this story and really thought about it wonders, what in the world was he writing? Was he writing out Deuteronomy 17? Or was he looking around the group and looking at somebody and goes, I know what you've done, and he writes, embezzling. Oh, she's guilty of adultery, you too, and he writes the name of the person that he committed adultery with. I mean, these are just things people have made up, and they all would make good movies, you know, but we don't know what he wrote. Deuteronomy 17, what it says is that if someone's caught in adultery, they are to be stoned, and the person to cast the first stone should be the witness. But Jesus adds something to it. He doesn't call for the witness, and the witness doesn't make himself known in this situation either. But Jesus says, you're right. Essentially, he goes, you're right. The law does say she should be stoned. And so I want whichever one of you is without sin, you cast the first stone, and then we'll all follow along. This perfect trap where he was going to be had no matter what he said didn't work. And it says they all just kind of wander off. The older ones first, and then the younger ones. That's a lot more fun to say now that I'm older, you know. Because the older people saw instantly that their trap hadn't worked. Their scheme had failed. The younger ones caught on eventually. And Jesus turns to the woman and say, "Where'd everybody go? Where are your condemners?" She goes, "Aren't there any left?" She goes, "Nope, no, sir. They've gone." And so they all wander off, and she's just left there with Jesus by herself. She's actually left alone with the one person in the whole crowd that actually could have thrown the first stone. But he didn't do it. He said, "Go and leave your life of sin." So everybody goes away, and then in a little bit, people gather again, and Jesus starts to teach again. And the first thing he says is, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." John said from the beginning in John 1, you know, the light that gives light, the life that gives light to all men was coming into the world. And the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not grasped it or comprehended it. So in this situation, you know, both the woman who was caught and the Pharisees stepped into the light of Jesus' presence. And the effect on them was really different, but it was the same light. You know, what does light do? I have this picture in my mind of this big dark room with a spotlight shining down right in the middle. This kind of hard edge spotlight that's so intense that it makes the darkness outside it seem that much darker. And in that light there are people who are there, and they're walking around in that light. But then out in the darkness, there are people out there too, and they're walking around, and they can't see where they're going, and they're running into each other, and they're tripping over things, and they're hurting themselves, and they're hurting other people. But there's one comfort there, and that is nobody can see them. And when they step into the light, they can see where they're going. They're not tripping over each other and hurting each other and hurting themselves and living in this frustration. You ever have those frustration dreams where you're trying to get away from something and you get up and run and you slip and fall and you get back up and you fall again? I hope I am not the only one that has those dreams. Where you're trying to do something and you try and you fail and you try and you fail and you try and you fail. I even have these dreams from time to time, and I don't understand this because I just don't play golf very much, but sometimes I dream I'm with my brother or with some friends and we're trying to play golf, and I put my ball up on the tee and it falls off. And then I set it back up and it falls off again. And I'm looking around and everybody's going, "Come on, man." And I put it back up there and it falls. And I have that dream, and it is a frustration dream, but the interesting thing is when I actually do get it teed up and actually can hit the ball, that's more frustrating. So I don't know how my dreams work. But that's the picture I have in the darkness and then in the light. And because light exposes and light shows the way. That's two things that light does. And Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And I think of that in terms of Isaiah 42. And he says, you're going to be a light. And what happens is you are going to free those, release those who are sitting in dungeons of darkness. The light of Jesus exposed sin and emptiness and slavery. The sin of adultery was brought into the light, but also the sin of deceit and self-righteousness and the condemning nature of their religious practices. Jesus exposes who we really are, not just to everybody else, but he exposes who we are to us. But light also shows the way. And this light that came into the world to give, that was the light of life, and it gives light to all men, is to show the way to freedom, not condemnation. Freedom from the dungeon of darkness. But things can go dark. I don't know if any, I might be wrong, but I don't think anybody ever sets out to have a marriage that ends up being devastated or even totally destroyed by adultery. I don't think that's what this woman set out to do. But sometimes relationships go dark. Relationships turn dark. And this relationship, this thing that you thought would be, that at last I'm going to be loved. I'm going to experience joy in my life like I never thought I'd be able to. And I've been lonely so long. God, thank you so much for sending me this woman, for sending me this man. It's going to be awesome. And then it's not awesome. And you start looking elsewhere. And it's not what you intended. And it becomes dark. And it's like you're in a dungeon of darkness. In the same way, I don't think anybody sets out to participate in a form of religion that's legalistic and condemning and self-justifying. You set out and you buy in and you commit yourself to it because you think it's going to make a difference. The Pharisees thought, we're going to purify Israel. We're going to bring Israel back to its glory. And what started out as a really noble focus on passionate, zealous obedience to the commands of God became a system where they would build up rule upon rule upon rule around God's rules. And they became so much more passionate about their own rules than God's, and missing the heart and the spirit of God's law, so that they were just reacting in frustration and in condemning control, trying to manage the sin of everybody around and believing that it was going to bring about God's blessing. And they ended up sitting in a dungeon of religious darkness. So, here's a woman sitting in a dungeon of relational darkness, and she finds the light of life. And there are people sitting in dungeons of religious darkness, and they are still too blind to see it. after Jesus says he's the light of the world, they go, no, you're not the light of the world. You're just testifying on your own behalf. Your testimony's not valid. You are not who you claim to be. Jesus goes on, this is another one of those things I'm not preaching about, but you got to check this out. Verse 28, it says, so Jesus says, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one I claim to be, and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me. Joe already preached about this, so I don't need to. I'm the light of the world. No, you're not. When you've lifted me up, you will know that I'm the one I claim to be. They lifted him up on the cross. What happened? From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came on the face of the earth. See, we've already been told that it was just lasted 3 hours. I think they didn't know if the light was ever going to come back on. But I don't have time to preach about that. Jesus confronted relational darkness, religious darkness. Are you sitting in a dungeon of darkness today? Did you set out to do something and you thought it was going to be great and it just turned dark? The good news is Jesus has good news for you. Jesus talks to this woman and you know, I don't know what she expected. I can imagine what she expected. I don't know if she expected to come out of there alive. But I know she didn't expect to be treated with compassion and mercy and grace. John 1, John says that the Word became flesh and lived with among us, and we have gazed on his glory, the glory of the only begotten, full of grace and truth. In Jesus' response to this woman, he says, I don't condemn you. People in dungeons of relational darkness and dungeons of religious darkness came into Jesus' presence, and he bathed the whole thing in grace. Now, there's a lot of unanswered questions here because life is messy. Jesus didn't condemn her, so does that mean she could just go right back home, go back to her husband, and they would live happily ever after? I don't know about that one. But it's good to, you know, these stories, they happened in real people's lives, and there was like real life stuff that went on, but what we see is the heart of God here. But the way that woman stood in front of Jesus is the way that every one of us stands before God. Completely, utterly in need of being bathed in grace and mercy and compassion. We're hopeless without that. Hopeless. When we stand before God, in his grace and his mercy, Jesus covers our nakedness. Jesus covers our shame. And after he bathes us in grace, then he bathes us in truth and says, go and leave your life of sin. He doesn't try to strike a balance between grace and truth. He brings the full measure of both. And he says, I don't condemn you, but go and leave your life of sin. Later on in chapter 8, Jesus says, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. But Jesus came as the light to free us, to release us from the dungeons of darkness. Jesus says, I don't condemn you, but he loves us too much to leave us in the dungeon, and he invites us to come out. Are you walking in darkness in some way today? Jesus doesn't condemn you, but he says, go forward, move forward, and leave your life of sin. Come out of the dungeon. Whatever that dungeon is, come out of it. Let's pray.